Our auditorium class, we are finishing up 1 Peter, and so we're ready to begin in chapter 4 and verse 12. And Peter, again, is dealing with the problem that shortly these Christians are going to be suffering, so he puts this in the context of the life of the Christian. We'll be able to draw some overview here as we wrap this up. This, again, is a more abbreviated outline of what we've started with. And so looking back over the book, we've had the fact that we've been created as a new people in Christ, born again to this living hope, born out of the living and abiding Word of God as the seed that imparts that same quality and character to us. And so we get a series of instructions about what kind of behavior and conduct is expected of God's people. And then that is followed by behaviors, what we are obligated, what we owe those of this world that we have various relationships with, all exemplified by the example of Christ at the very end of chapter 2, that he left an example for us to follow, walking in his footsteps. And Peter says that's the very thing we've been called to. And then, beginning in chapter 3 and verse 13, and only really beginning here, does Peter begin explicitly dealing with the problem of suffering. And again, I think that's very telling because it says to us that the main thing is not whether you suffer or not. The main thing is, do you fulfill your responsibility to God and your fellow man? Do you fulfill the great commandment to love the Lord your God with all of your being? Do you love your fellow man as yourself? And if you do that and it causes suffering, well, that's just a byproduct sometimes of what happens, but the main thing is you have to do what's right. What's right by God, what's right by your fellow man. And in chapter 3, verse 13 through chapter 4, verse 11, which we looked at last week, we saw that Peter addressed the possibility that our suffering, if we handle ourselves correctly in this world, keep our conduct, behavior proper, that can have an impact on the world in which we live. It can have a redemptive effect upon those of the world, just as Christ's own suffering had a redemptive effect. And just as Christ's suffering did not save everybody, not everybody responded positively or favorably to it, not everybody's going to respond positively or favorably to our suffering. And so again, it's just like Peter said back in chapter 2, Christ is a living stone, rejected by men, chosen of great value to God. We are living stones. We're going to be rejected by some people, but God will choose us and place great value on us just as surely. But now, beginning in chapter 4, verse 12, Peter's going to continue talking about suffering in the life of the Christian, but now he doesn't speak of it in terms of what impact it has on the world in which we live. He speaks of it purely in terms of the fact that it is all to God's glory, and that's what it boils down to. So then to look at this particular section a little bit more closely, you'll notice the section on elders or the shepherds in chapter 5, the first five verses there particularly, is bracketed by some general teaching or instruction about suffering and how it leads to glory. And that suggests that this instruction about the elders is not just kind of a side note at the end that, Peter just had some leftover, paper to write on and say, well, let me think of something else I can say. Oh, yeah, say something about elders, I'll throw that in there at the end. It's central to his discussion here about what's going on in the context of this suffering. Well, I'll start again by saying, are there any loose ends or anything we've not adequately dealt with, or any questions you've pondered, something that provoked your thought over the week? Okay, well, let's notice beginning here in chapter 4 and verse 12, "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory you may rejoice exceedingly. If you are ridiculed for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. Make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer or thief or evildoer or a troublesome meddler. But if one suffers as a Christian, he's not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name. For it is time for judgment to begin with the house of God. And if with us first, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if it is with difficulty that the righteous is saved, what will become of the godless man and the sinner? Therefore, those also who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. Well, you know, the first thing Peter starts out by saying is don't be surprised. You know, earlier he had said at the beginning of chapter 4, the Gentiles are surprised that you don't run into the same kind of excess and misconduct that they do. And so there is a surprise on their side, but Christians don't need to be surprised. We have been taught basically what to expect. We know what the world did to our Lord. They hated him. Are we surprised that they will hate his disciples? So we're not surprised. The word surprised is related to the word strange. They're part of the same word family. So don't be strangified about the fiery ordeal as if something strange were happening. Or probably more ordinarily we would say, don't be surprised if something surprising was happening to you. But to the degree we can share in the suffering of Christ, we rejoice in that. And that's the same thing James has said at the beginning of his letter. Count it all joy when you fall into various trials, because you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and endurance will have its outcome, which is our spiritual maturity. And that's a very similar idea to what Peter says at the beginning of his letter, and he returns to it here again at the end. And so he's not talking about suffering in terms of what good it might do for your neighbor or what influence it might have on a pagan, but he's saying, you know, this is to God's glory. There is a blessing that comes because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon us, and that we're imitating Christ, and that alone is sufficient for causing us to celebrate. Now, in verse 15, he says, don't suffer as a murderer or a thief. Now, why do you suppose he picks out those two particular?
That's a different word. Parsco isn't pathos. Does that mean spiritual? Or pathos means physical, and parsco means spiritual?
Suffering? Oh, talk about suffering?
Suffering.
I don't know that you could.
There's two different words there.
Yeah. I don't know you make that. I mean, they could be distinguished, but not necessarily. Here this idea of suffering as a murderer. You know, if you get arrested by the police because you murdered somebody, and you go to prison or you're executed, well, there's no credit in that. You know, it's like, oh, I'm suffering for the Lord. You know, no, you're getting what you deserve because you did something evil. So you don't glory in that, obviously. But why murdering and thieving? Any ideas? Is that a particular problem among the Christians, you suppose? Or what kind of crime? Go ahead, Nathan. You want to say something.
They seem to be two kind of exemplary sins against your neighbor.
Okay. And they tend to represent two categories of crimes. You know, about murder, what do we think of that as a crime as?
Capital.
Or used to, anyway, right? A capital offense, something you execute somebody for. Stealing is not typically something you would execute somebody for. Even, you know, the thieves that are crucified with Jesus, that term is used of, you know, insurrectionists and violent robbers and things like that, not just somebody, you know, stole your PIN number on your ATM card or something. And so corporal a crime like thieving, or a capital crime like murder, and then evildoer is a generic term for a criminal. And so that appears to be along that same line, just any kind of crime that you might be guilty of in the eyes of the state. But the last thing he mentions is this troublesome meddler, and this is the only place this word occurs in the Bible. And it's a form of the word episkopos, which you may be familiar with, because when we talk about the overseer, the word Episcopalian, the name of the Episcopalian church comes from this idea of the overseer or the bishop. Well, this is a special kind of overseer. He's overseeing everybody else's business. You know, this kind of meddler person who's always sticking his nose in an inappropriate way into people's lives. And it's kind of interesting because I know a lot of people think that's exactly what Christians ought to be doing. You know, we're kind of the moral watchdog of the neighborhood, that we ought to be looking down our nose at everybody and passing judgment on them and telling them what to do. And, you know, you have to be very careful about that. It's just a fact that a lot of Christians come across as this holier-than-thou, judgmental kind of person. And it oughtn't to be that way. You know, it should be the same principle as I'm an imperfect person, I'm a sinner, but I'm just thankful I have found the gospel of Jesus Christ, and I just want to share that with you in a very humble and, unoffensive kind of way. And, I've heard the analogy before of, you know, sharing the gospel with somebody should be just the same as one hungry person telling another hungry person where to find bread. You know, we're all starving, but we found a place to find that which can satisfy our need. Well, that's what we're trying to share with people. We're not trying to run their life and judge them and make ourselves feel superior to them. And so that's a kind of a meddling and micromanaging. I don't know a lot of other ways you could look at it. Don't suffer because of that. And so I think that's particularly telling here. I'm not on the verge of going out murdering anyone or stealing anyone in my neighborhood. I could very easily, however, become one of these meddlesome people who, can make myself offensive or irritating in the way that I try to share the gospel with somebody. So we need to guard against that. And particularly in sharing the gospel, because I've known some people who even prided themselves in being very brusque and, just really downright offensive in the way they spoke with people. And sharing the gospel with them. I have a good friend. He was in the Navy, and he had a commanding officer come in. And he said, I see you're a Catholic. And he said, yes, sir. And he said, well, you want me to tell you why you're going to hell? And just fortunately for him, he was of such a seeking kind of person, he was willing to overlook that kind of introduction to the gospel. But I certainly wouldn't recommend that, Paul tells us in Colossians chapter 4, we need to make sure our speech is seasoned like with salt, season it with grace, that we may speak to people in a way that's proper for the gospel. And we got to keep in mind that the content of the gospel is not the only thing we're sharing. You know, we're sharing it with our life as well. And if I were to say to somebody, there is a God, there is no God, you'd say, well, that's confusing. You know, you're saying two things. Well, that's no different than saying it one way with our mouth and saying it the other way with our life. We're being confusing, and we're contradicting what we're saying. And so we need to guard against that. Greg?
So you're saying that if we suffer because we meddle in other people's lives, just even if it's for the purpose of the gospel, that's not righteous suffering?
That would be my conclusion, yes, that if you just make yourself as offensive to people and they, so they resent you and they don't want to talk to you, and you just go around and say, well, see, we all suffer for the gospel. They're just hard-hearted and they don't want to hear the truth. And we're just fooling ourselves, Now, again, there's a degree of judgment in that. I mean, there are some people that are going to be merely offended by the fact that you say, well, you want to have a Bible study or something. They're so insecure about what they believe and so on. I'm not saying that anybody that's offended by us, that we've done something wrong, but we do need to be careful that we're not giving occasion for offense. Again, that we're prayerfully and humbly going about trying to share the gospel with people in a way that is appropriate. So, what about suffering as a Christian? Well, again, just the very name of Christ that we wear, if that's why we're ridiculed, if that's why we get into trouble, we can glorify God. Who is this Christ whose name we wear? Well, that's a reminder again to go back to something like chapter 2. He is the crucified Christ, the one who suffered, the just for the unjust, the one who was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and we're walking in his footsteps. So a lot of people have the wrong picture of Christ in their mind. You know, I've often said, you know, we don't have a Lord's Supper table that says, in remembrance of me, but, you know, when you see that kind of inscription, well, me, who is this me we're thinking of? Who is the me that we're remembering? And a lot of people have this Jesus of their own fantasy, their own imagination, that is not even remotely what the Bible presents about Jesus. It is the crucified Christ, one who suffered, one who sacrificed himself, one who was suffering to serve people who didn't deserve it. That's the name I wear. What does that mean? Well, it means I'm willing to suffer. I'm ready to sacrifice. I'm ready to serve rather than be served. That's what it means to wear the name of Christ. And so if I go through the same thing the Lord goes through, it's like, hallelujah, praise the Lord, because this is what I have been called to. And if it's God's will that I suffer these things, then he must have some good reason and purpose for all of that. Now, he says now in verse 17, it's time for judgment to begin with the house of God. And if it starts with us first, what's going to happen to those that are not part of the house of God? Well, let me ask you a question. This image of the house of God, what are the different ways that's used in the Bible? What is the house of God? Okay, a family is often one use of that term. We're part of a family. God's a father, and we're children, brothers and sisters together. And then there's another prominent way that's used, particularly in the Old Testament, the temple. And so the question comes up, well, which one does Peter really have in mind here? If you'll turn over to Ezekiel chapter 9. It'd really be interesting if we go back and read the first 11 chapters of Ezekiel, but we don't have time to do that. But a lot of people know that it begins with a rather strange visual depiction of God riding on this throne chariot, kind of a divine taxi of sorts. And the whole point of this is that this means of transportation has come to pick up the glory of God and take it away from the temple. And it's a very graphic portrayal of Ezekiel's teaching that the glory of God is leaving. And, you know, we use the expression of rats leaving a sinking ship. You know, the rats know what's going on. They're getting out of there before they drown. Well, if the glory of God is leaving the temple, what is the only conclusion you can come to? What's going to happen to the temple? It's going to be destroyed. I mean, it's just as certain as can be. And so as part of this process, we get to chapter 9, and here's some imagery that is very similar to what we saw in the book of Revelation with God marking people. But the Lord says in verse 4, go through the midst of the city, even through the midst of Jerusalem, put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations which are being committed in its midst. But to the others, he said in my hearing, go through the city after him and strike. Do not let your eye have pity and do not spare. Utterly slay old men, young men, maidens, little children, and women, but do not touch any man on whom is the mark, and you shall start from my house. So they started with the elders who were before the temple. And here's this picture again of God sending out somebody to, he knows which ones are the righteous and they're not contributing to, they don't appreciate this idolatry and all of that that the others have gotten caught up in. And so God has a way of marking them to preserve them from his judgment, but then immediately behind the guy that's going around marking comes the instruments of God's judgment to slay everyone that was among the wicked. Well, you see, he starts at the temple. And then you notice, who does he start with at the temple? The elders. Now, where have we heard that word before? Tonight. In chapter 5, again. Immediately, he's going to be talking about these elders in chapter 5. Well, I don't think that's an accident. He's making a point here about the role of the elders in this whole process. So time for judgment to begin at the house of God, the temple of God, is how he must be understanding it here as he alludes to that passage from Ezekiel. And, of course, that's also the image that was used back in chapter 2. Christ is the foundation stone of this spiritual house that we are being built up into as living stones. We are this temple of the Lord that is also a holy priesthood offering up spiritual sacrifices. And then we come to one other Old Testament reference. This reference to, from Proverbs chapter 11, verse 31. If it is with difficulty that the righteous is saved, what will become of the godless man and the sinner? Or some translations say, if the righteous are scarcely saved. And that's a little bit different way of looking at it. The one view, it kind of makes it sound like you do just the absolute best you can, give 110%, and you're just barely going to be saved by the skin of your teeth. And so if that's true, then the person is only given 109%. What's going to happen to him? Well, he's going to be lost. You know, so you really got to buckle down and pull yourself up by your bootstraps, because you're just barely going to make it if you do make it. The other way of understanding what Peter is saying is that our salvation is accompanied with difficulty. It comes to us through difficulty. First, of course, Christ had to suffer in order for us to be saved. And so there's a great difficulty right there without which we could not be saved. And then in this context, we too are called to share in the suffering of Christ, to participate in his difficulty and his suffering. Our sufferings are not something separate and unique and different from the suffering of Christ. And so we cannot be saved without participating in the suffering of Christ. And the point would be, of course, if God allows his own people to suffer, if God sees fit that those that he loves, those who are his friends, his children, must go through suffering, what kind of suffering is in store for those who are his enemies and who turn their backs on the Lord? So, you know, and between those two options, I think the second one is probably preferable. Nathan?
I think it's natural to make a distinction between suffering that you endure as a Christian in the hands of evil people and the judgment of God is something different. But this really seems to make a connection between suffering as a Christian for doing good and the judgment of God beginning God's house. Is that to be understood as the suffering as chastisement that makes us better, or the suffering is just something that is under God's oversight because he's in charge of everything, or is there a different kind of connection between
the two? Well, that's a good question. I mean, I don't think there's any one answer for why someone suffers. I mean, clearly, I sometimes suffer because I made a stupid decision and I'm suffering the natural consequences of my sin. And other times I suffer solely because, you know, someone chooses to be evil against me. Craig?
Is judgment fear more of the idea you said previously of the refinement of, I mean, you're going to see who has faith and who has done and who doesn't. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, I've often referred to the Christian life as a testing period or a probationary period, and to use the imagery from chapter 1, the refining of our faith that is perfected through trial. And it's very similar to what Jesus said in John chapter 12, that it's not as if we await the final judgment, that there's going to be this judge who sets and pronounces judgment on us. I mean, that's true, but in fact, in reality, we are being presently judged by the very words of Jesus as to whether we're doing them or not doing them. So very similar to what you're saying. Every decision we make is a moment of decision making, revealing what our faith is, whether it's what it ought to be or not. So I think that's appropriate to look at it as a process of judgment.
Well, my question really, I guess, goes back to specifically verse 16. Suffering as a Christian i.e. as opposed to suffering as a murderer or a thief or an evil person.
Right.
So this is some kind of suffering that is being brought upon you because of the way that you're living your life. And then that is immediately connected with judgment beginning in the household of faith. And that's not a connection that I think we would naturally make, that if you're doing good things, if you're living a righteous life, and you're being persecuted because of that, that's judgment beginning in the household of faith.
Right. Well, to connect that with what Greg is saying, if there's some kind of a process of revelation that's going on among God's people, in other words, as they listen to what God has revealed and they act upon it in obedience and they're being faithful, and that itself is a manifestation to the world of the right way to live and what's important in life and so on, that's going to happen among God's people. I mean, who else out there is going to be manifesting this message of the gospel and enduring suffering in a proper way that, you know, has some purpose to it and so on? So I think that may be part of what he's getting at here, is it's with God's people that God is manifesting to the world what a real life of, you know, the life of Jesus, the life of the crucified Christ is that of suffering and sacrifice and service. Well, you don't see that in the world. You're going to see it among Christ's followers. And so it has to be with God's house where this, you know, kind of behavior must be manifest. And so I do think God is using the suffering that comes against his people, you know, even that's intentionally targeted at them precisely because they're being righteous, as a means of manifesting that to the world, if that makes sense. I don't know if I'm explaining that very clearly. Adam?
Seem like he's trying to carry this idea that, yes, the suffering that you're enduring as a Christian is difficult, but you have to remember it's going to be far worse for those who are not right with Christ. And because he emphasizes that idea twice here, that you make your suffering bad. What about God's? So it seems like he's trying to make the point that, look, you know, you're in this hour of suffering. Don't give up, because if you do, then you become among the godless, and then you're going to suffer along with them. It's going to be far worse than had you endured. And so that, then, you know, making the connection there with Ezekiel, that picture of judgment beginning at the house of God and starting with the elders, but don't touch anyone with the mark, is again this judging, going back to the comment about refining. And so, okay, you're going through this test, and are you going to prove to truly be a Christian, or will you wind up being just like everybody else?
Okay. Well, I think that's a good analogy, where certainly the people who lived in Jerusalem in the time of the Babylonian, you know, invasion and the burning of the temple and all that, you know, they did suffer a great deal, but on the other hand, they were spared this greater judgment of the destruction that God is depicting here in Ezekiel. And I think in the same way you can see that here, where, yeah, Christians are suffering, but the greater suffering of condemnation will come, you know, to those who are not suffering according to God's will. And, of course, that brings back just the general principle that everybody suffers. The only difference is some people will suffer for a purpose, which the Christian knows what that purpose is, at least in some general term. Others who suffer, it just seems to be pretty meaningless. And so I've given the example before of, you know, someone who has cancer, and so they say, oh, well, there's no God because he let me get cancer, or a loved one has cancer. Well, you reject God, but you still got cancer, you know. Now you're going to deal with your cancer without God. You know, that's a great improvement, you know. No, you're still suffering cancer, but now you have no hope, you have no purpose, no sense of meaning about anything. So what's the point, you know? But we can suffer in a way that honors God and that will serve some purpose. Greg?
Explicitly in Philippians 3, that he wants to attain to the suffering of Christ so that he is that what they're supposed to do? You follow in the example of Christ. He suffered, and God raised him. So if you're suffering as a Christian, you're suffering Christ's life. Therefore, there's this expectation of resurrection. There's this expectation of vindication.
Okay. Now you mean physical resurrection or more spiritual kind of resurrection? Okay. Yeah, I don't know. We'd have to contrast the two necessarily, but I just think of that in terms of Philippians, because he talks about sharing in the death of Christ, which in a sense is obviously not literal, but so you wonder to what he means about sharing in the resurrection as well. But these are all fascinating things to ponder. We'll have to move on, though, to get finished with 1 Peter. But verse 19 I have described as really the key verse to the whole book. You could boil the book down to this, basically. Those who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. I mean, that pretty much sums up what the book is about. What is the will of God? What does God want? And if it is His purpose and will that you suffer in the process of you going about doing what's right, then if that's what it takes to do what's right, then so be it. And you just trust God to take care of everything else. And that's really what it does boil down to. I know what I'm supposed to do. God's told me that. I know what's right. I know what's wrong. And if I just concern myself with trying to do that the best of my ability, these bigger questions like, why did this happen? You know, why did this loved one get cancer? Why did, you know, well, I may not ever know the ultimate answer to that question. And I might get to heaven and God not even tell me. You know, He doesn't owe me an answer. Like Job never got an answer from God, at least the kind he was looking for. Well, God doesn't have to. I just trust He's got some good reason. And that's what brings us back to the cross again. When you see the Creator Himself hanging on a cross, going through what He does, solely because of His love for you and His willingness to sacrifice Himself for your sin and your rebellion and your rejection of Him, and even willing to do that all the while you're rejecting Him, there is no doubt that that God cares about me. And that whatever suffering I'm going through, it isn't because He's stupid or weak or doesn't care, that I just trust Him because He has shown Himself to be trustworthy. And that brings me back again to a principle that we've noted time and again, that, you know, a lot of times we look at suffering and we want to look at it in terms of what's fair. You know, I know all these other Christians, they don't suffer. Their little baby didn't die, or, you know, their marriage didn't break up, or their whatever. And it's just not fair. All the garbage I got to put up with, all the suffering I'm going through, it's just so extreme and so much worse than everybody else is going. You know, life isn't fair. And the moment you try to put your stand on what's fair, you've completely renounced any claim to the grace of God forgiving you for your sin. You know, thank God life is not fair. Thank God that He was willing to do what was the most unfair thing in the entire universe, and that is to forgive me of my sin. And if I live in complete abject misery and poverty and suffering and physical pain from now to the day I die, nothing of that could ever make up for the fact God has forgiven me of my sin. But it doesn't appear as if it's God's intention that His people live that way. Now, I'm not making light of the fact that some Christians do have a more serious degree of physical suffering than I ever have gone through. But we just have to trust God has some good reason and purpose for these things, and not to try to evaluate them on the basis of what's fair or comparing ourselves to other people, but always to remember He has forgiven me through Jesus Christ, and that outweighs really any other consideration. So I know I can trust Him because of that. And if I have to suffer, then so be it, you know. And that should be our general attitude. Well, if we don't get rid of, through the rest of, get rid of the last chapter. Well, we've done verse 19, which is the book in a nutshell. And then you'll come back and say, why didn't we just do verse 19 and be done with 1 Peter? But anyway, all right, chapter 5. Therefore, I exhort the elders among you as your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ, and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God, not for sordid gain, but with eagerness, nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but being examples to the flock. Then, when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that never fades away. In the same way, you who are younger, be subject to the elders, and all of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, because God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Well, we've studied about elders a good bit before. I'm not going to revisit all of that, but what do want to mention the possibility, at least, of reading these contrasts that Peter offers here as being really just one main contrast. That is, not serving as an elder, an overseer, under compulsion, but voluntarily. And I think most people read that in terms of, well, we talked this guy into being an elder, we twisted his arm, and he didn't really, you know, his heart wasn't in it or something. And certainly that would be bad, you know, that principle, we should avoid that, certainly. But I think what we have here basically are two specific ways of being compelled that Peter has under consideration. So, money and power are not to be our primary motivation. That should not be what compels us to serve. And so, I think the general statement of compulsion is explained in more detail with these two other things that he mentions. Doing the work for financial gain is not as much of a issue among most brethren that I know, because the practice of financial support of elders is not widespread among most Christians I know, but certainly it was done in the early church and is entirely appropriate, of course, because they are preachers and teachers of the word. But certainly this idea of power comes into play. And here's where we see this term lording it over. And this word only occurs four times in the New Testament. And one is obviously in 1 Peter chapter 5, where elders are told they can't lord it over people. And I've never met an elder who thought he did. You know, I've never met anyone who said, yep, I lord it over people. You know, but just because you don't use that expression doesn't mean you're not doing what the concept is. So what does it mean to lord it over? Well, it occurs in these parallel accounts in the Gospels where Jesus says, for example, in Mark 10, on this third occasion where the disciples are arguing about who's greatest in the kingdom, and, you know, James and John put their mother up to asking for being number one and number two next to Jesus. The others get all upset with James and John. And Jesus says, you know how things operate in this world. The great men exercise authority, lord it over one another. It's not to be this way among you. Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And therefore, the principle in the kingdom is, the one that is greatest is the one who's the servant, the one who makes himself slave of all. And here is a connection we need to appreciate, is the word Lord means the slave owner. And so, if you want to serve as an elder, are you the slave or are you the slave owner? You know, we have too many people want to be the Indian chief, you know, want to be the boss, want to be in charge, the way the world looks at such things. Of course, we use the term public servant. Well, it'd be nice if we really had an attitude of public service in our public servants. It almost becomes a term of derision. But this is the way the elders are to be. They are servants. They are slaves, not slave owners, and they shouldn't act like that. And the fourth place where this word is used is in Acts chapter 19 and verse 16, where that unclean spirit, you know, the seven sons of Sceva, say, we adjure you by this Jesus Paul preaches to come out of this man. And the unclean spirit's like, well, I know Jesus and I know Paul, but who do you think you are, you know? And this evil spirit, the guy, he leaps on these guys and lords it over them, and they flee from the house naked. It's a very graphic picture of a man who is imposing his will on the unwilling by physical force in this case. Well, that's what lording it over is. You're imposing your will on someone that is unwilling. You know, no, make them do what's right. Well, you can't do that. How's an elder supposed to make the brethren do what's right? Well, you can't do that. How does God make people do what's right? He can't. What? God can't make people do? Well, he could, but it would defeat his purpose. He's looking for people who willingly serve him, not because he holds a gun to somebody's head and forces them to do the right thing. And in the same way, we could start a policy of physically coercing people to do whatever we think they ought to do. I should always come to church every time the door is open. Well, we could get 100% church attendance by forcing people, but you're not going to change their heart for the better. The only way to change a person is persuade them with the power of a sacrificial life on the inside, which is God has done through Jesus Christ. And so the need for humility, he kind of winds up the letter with, that we should humble ourselves. We've talked about the importance of humility for a group of people working together. And he concludes with some exhortations here. Be alert, because the devil is seeking to destroy us. But we need to resist him. We need to cast our anxieties, our worries on the Lord. And then notice verse 10, after you've suffered for a little while, I don't care how long it is, it's short compared to eternity, the God of all grace who called you to his eternal glory in Christ will himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. And so again, in that last day, God himself will perfect us and make us fully and completely what we ought to be. And we, in the meanwhile, just do the best we can in humility to serve him, do what is right, and if need be, suffer in doing that. So hopefully that'll help us as we live our lives for the Lord day to day. We will be starting our study of Daniel on Sunday. So if you want to go ahead and be reading the book of Daniel through, you will be well served to that end. And then on Wednesday nights, we're going to be studying kind of how we got the Bible. And I think Guy is going to be teaching that class, should be beginning next week. So we'll look forward to those studies beginning. Thank you.